Hello and welcome to another episode of The Cocktail Conceit on the Rocks. My name is Adam, and I am a bartender working in Taipei, Taiwan.
Wow, that's a different place than usual, Adam.
That is a different place. Well, I don't know. Is it a different place than usual? Can we say usual since it's been a year since we did season one?
Yeah, it's true. So I'm Logan. I'm also a bartender. I'm still in Evansville, Indiana, unfortunately. I am bartending in different places now, though, so that's cool. Just to put a hat on it, yeah, we haven't recorded an episode in almost exactly a year. It's been like a year and a month or two, I think.
It's been a difficult year, as years during the pandemic are wont to be.
Yeah, the one that's still kind of going on a little bit, which is super cool.
But I think we're both in a more like settled down position now, so we have the ability to record, which is I should say.
Well, it's funny though. So like, since the last time we recorded, I have moved into a new place, and I've been here for a year. And Adam, you have lived in Hawaii, back in Evansville, and then into Taiwan. I believe. Is that right?
No, it was starting this podcast living in Columbus. Then moved to Hawaii trying to escape the pandemic. That failed. Moved back to Evansville. then went out to LA for 2 months to help a cousin. Went out to LA for 2 months to help a cousin look after her kids while going through a messy divorce. Got into a fight with a meth head, came back to Evansville again, and then finally moved to Taiwan, which was the goal from the very start.
You know what's really funny is that you had to go all the way to LA to fight a meth head, and it didn't happen here in Evansville.
I know, right?
Like, what are the odds? It's funny about that is you moved around all those places. I moved, and I literally moved across the street.
I remember that. You can see your old apartment from your current apartment.
Yeah. I moved most of the things from my old apartment, like, literally.
By
like,
foot.
It's not even a block. It's, like, literally, I could see my new place from my old place.
Talking about things that have changed, do you want to run down the things that are going to be changing in Season 2?
Yeah, so we are kind of retooling a little bit. We kind of played with the idea of doing a specifically rock-themed podcast. The film star, the movie star,
Dwayne the Rock Johnson is the best.
I feel like movie star doesn't really convey
superstar.
What the Rock is. Yeah, he's a superstar. You know, he can do anything. Pretty much. Has he put an album out yet? I bet he's going to put an album out. I'm sure
Not Childish Gambino. He's also not John Cena.
John Cena can rap. That is weird. John Cena also on a really good trajectory right now. I like John Cena as an actor. Which is funny because he used to be kind of garbage right around the time The Rock was starting the same things. So we're retooling a little bit. We're not going to be picking specific things that we're doing. We're just going to go through the chronology of all the Rock movies because it seems like a fun thing to do, and it just makes our lives a little bit easier in picking topics.
Yeah, it's a lot less of a time commitment to watch a 1.5 to 2.5 hour movie every few weeks instead of, you know, reading a novel or...
Right, or listening to an album or, you know, doing a Hamilton 3 times. Wait, 2 times? 4 times? 6 times?
We'll just round it up, call it 3.
Yeah, let's call it 3.
Welcome to Cocktail Conceit, : On the Rocks.
On the Rocks.
We're going to be starting...
One of us needs to record a On the Rocks. Like
On the Rocks.
You know, like it just has like a little background of this. It's really funny.
We're going to be starting with the first... Oh, we're only doing motion pictures, by the way. Mm-hmm. We're not doing any sort of, like, cameos on Star Trek. We're just doing motion pictures where The Rock is a, highly billed actor.
Yeah, so, I think that's... I think we're going to avoid anything he is only in snippets of, which actually might count this movie out if you really...
considerate. No cameos or bit roles, which might count out the movie we're doing today, which is The Mummy Returns. But he is billed as like the fourth actor on on like the title
he's
card.
So highly built, it's stupid. I was trying to do research on this. I was looking at the Wikipedia page, trying to see if there was anything about the production of this movie that caused them to like cut out parts of The Rock, like. That maybe they had tried to have The Rock in it more and like it didn't work, like it, or maybe there was like a scheduling conflict or something, and there's just no information about it at all.
No, so, you know, I think they were making this movie and it was all getting made and all being done.
Oh wait,
What
movie are we doing?
Oh, we're doing The Mummy Returns. We're doing The Mummy Returns.
We were doing The Mummy Returns. Go ahead.
I think this movie was getting made and getting done, and then they greenlit the Scorpion King movie with starring The Rock, which is his first big leading man role that we're going to be doing in the next episode.
Right.
But they decided, hey, we have... you know, The Mummy Returns, and they already had the plot device of, oh, the Scorpion King, you know, wake him up, oh, whoever kills the Scorpion King gets to control his army. Well, let's just film a little section at the beginning of the movie with The Rock to go in the background of this exposition that we're going to have in the beginning anyhow. And then at the very end of the movie, when they fight the Scorpion King, and they already filmed them fighting the Scorpion King, let's just make that into a CGI Dwayne The Rock Johnson monster. Because they're fighting, you know, CGI anyway, so it could easily have just been, you know, a big gladiator dude, or it could be Dwayne Johnson as a Scorpion Centaur.
So bad.
I fully believe that when Brendan Fraser was filming those scenes, especially like the ending fight scenes, they were like, yeah, and then the Scorpion King is going to come out and he's just going to be some sort of big CGI scorpion monster. And he's like, oh, okay. And then on premiere day when he's like, huh, I'm fighting The Rock, but as a scorpion centaur. That was like probably a surprise to them.
I think you're probably 100% right on that. I would imagine what's probably going on here is that the studio definitely had like a contract for The Rock, and they had this movie already planned, and they're like, "Well, we're gonna do a Rock like one-off. Like, what do we want to do? Like, what would The Rock be good in?" And then they had the idea for like a vague movie, and then they're already making this other movie with the Scorpion King, and it's like, "Oh, well, we got The Rock.
Let's just shoehorn this in here."
He's on contract. We can probably throw this other movie together pretty quick because, you know, it's just like a medieval-y kind of movie, which I'm sure the budget on The Scorpion King was pretty low. That movie can't have a high budget. Yeah. There's no way. This movie actually had a decent budget. I was surprised because it... I mean...
Well, the first Mummy movie, like, did really well, so of course this is going to have a pretty decent budget.
Well, yeah, I guess that's a fair point because, like, I mean, I think the first Mummy movie had like a pretty low budget, but like did very well generally because it was like just like a white horse kind of movie. You know what I mean? Like it just came out of nowhere, and was good. And I miss the days when you could just make a kitschy kind of jokey movie that was action, comedy. And it would just work, and it didn't have to be tied to anything else.
And you could just give Brendan Fraser work.
You know, those were the days. Those were the days, Adam.
All right.
Those were the pre-9/11 days.
So, other than us talking about the movie real fast there, I wanted to get into our normal intro, which is Logan. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty okay. I just fully started a new job. I've been working at the place for a while, but I have now kind of transitioned to mostly working at one place instead of working at like three different places like I was.
Yeah, you're about to actually like take over running that bar and making the menu and stuff.
Yeah, I've already made the new menu for the bar. I'm basically head bartender. Our previous manager, who is a friend and roommate of mine actually, just left the place I'm working at here in Evansville. It's called our Academy, for the record. It's like an arcade bar with a cocktail bar upstairs, but I'm basically like head bartender upstairs and running their full cocktail program. So I'm going to be doing... I've already built the cocktail list for upstairs and downstairs. I'll be training some of the bartenders, like, this week or next week to make all of those. And then, you know, have that new menu roll out this weekend. I'm excited about it.
I'm really happy for you. Like, I'm really happy that you finally found, like, a place to... Like, you finally found... You got your feet back under you after the last bar that you and I worked at in Evansville suddenly closed.
Oh, yeah. That was the... That was the thing that happened. The big thing that we have not talked about in the past year is that, well, first of all, Adam, you and I got to work together behind a bar for the first time, which was really
yeah,
cool.
That was really enjoyable.
It was really, I was so caught up in like how busy and crazy things were, but there was a moment where I realized it like before you left. I was like, you know what? I'm really glad we got to do this. It's just a cool thing that we got to do. Because you living in different countries and all over the place, I wasn't sure that was the thing that would ever happen. And then, like, you know, the fact that I was just able to get you on at the bar that I was working at while you were here worked out really well. And glad that
we
could do
that. Yeah, we had a solid, like, 3-4 months. It was just a good summer.
Yeah, it was a good summer, and we got to throw you and Kat a wedding party, which was cool. Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got married.
A thing before that. Yeah, Adam got married. Although I think you were already technically married when we were still recording.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah.
I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure.
We did the paperwork part really early.
Yeah. But you guys did like the actual like, not like ceremony, but we had all of our friends together and you know did the thing at the bar that I worked at. And that was a fun time. That was a really good time. And then that whole bar imploded because
the owner freaked out, fired all of the staff, and everyone who he didn't fire walked out.
Quit, basically, yeah.
And his motivation behind it was no motivation at all. It was just like...
His motivation was, I can probably make more money doing it this other way that I want to do things. And then it turns out when you screw over your entire staff and they all quit, you don't make more money.
I almost want to think the motivation was boredom, because he's just like, man, you know what? The pandemic is happening. There's just not enough going on in my life right now. What if I fire half my staff and just see how my other staff react?
Yeah, what if I just make everything in my life more difficult for 6 months? I actually just found out that the restaurant downstairs from Fidel's got it's officially purchased by somebody else. But Fidel's
so his entire plan of let's fire half my staff and see how that goes for me ends up with him losing every restaurant he owns over the course of a year.
Pretty much, pretty close, man. Pretty close, yeah.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see how it works out for him.
Bold strategy, Cotton. Yeah, so that was fun. That was a fun time. But yeah, I've been kind of bouncing around different places
since
working.
Then.
I was serving at one place in town. It was like, you know, it's a good serving job. Like, it wasn't bad, but it definitely wasn't, you know, fulfilling, and I wasn't enjoying it as much because I'm used to getting to be kind of creative and doing the cocktail stuff, which I toot my own horn, but I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing more than probably most bartenders, at least in Evansville. I was working there, and then one of my old coworkers, Reese, who was the manager of Academy, was working at Academy. I started picking up there kind of on the weekends to help him out upstairs. And then one of my other coworkers, started... she is now the general
like
manager.
She's
the general manager. She is, like, the full manager of Shimmick's Kitchen, which is, like, a restaurant. It's, like, a... It's not quite fine dining, but it's not quite not. It's kind of somewhere in between there. And I've been
upscale dining.
Yeah, upscale dining is probably the best way. Like, they do like nice ticketed dining events throughout the week, like once or twice a month, and then they do just regular dinner service, and then they do brunch on Sundays. I mostly work brunch because I brunch bartended a lot. So
I have never brunch bartended. I've bartended on Sunday evenings a lot, but never brunch.
I started Sunday evenings. That's where I started at. And then the money is in brunch. If you work at a place that does brunch, you make a lot of money bartending brunches. It's just a thing. It really sucks. It's one of those, like, double-edged sword.
Because you're bartending
kind of
at 11 a.m.
Well, if you're lucky, because yeah. most of the places I've worked at, it's like, you know, like currently it's 11. We open at 11, but I have to be there at like 10 or something, like 9:30. But it's like, it's definitely a double-edged sword where it's like, you kind of have to, kind of got to get used to closing on a Saturday night at a bar and then just wake it up in 6 hours and coming right back in and working somewhere else. And that's if you're lucky, you know, 6 hours
of sleep. I could not do that. You basically just like stay awake. And at the end of a Saturday night, so like at the very tail end of like the hardest part of the week.
Yep.
Now you have to wake up the earlier than you have the rest of the week to do another shift. Like, no, fuck that. I don't want to do that.
Like, there are things that I really don't like about it. It really sucks. There's things I really do like about it, which is, like, making more money, because it's on a Sunday, a day that I would usually not make any money or lose money because I go out and drink or something.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then B, it, like, actually kind of helps reset my my sleep schedule a little bit for the next week. Usually Mondays, I almost always have off, but I just sleep in. And if I have that Sunday where I get to, I have to wake up early, then at least on Monday, I won't sleep in until like 2 or 3 p.m. Because that's what I would normally end up doing. So okay, like,
I can see that.
There's like pros and cons. It sucks. The big thing is if you get really used to opening, doing all of your opening setup, like half awake, it works out really well.
you can just roll up like with your eyes like completely closed and like a savant with just your hands moving.
Yeah, that's basically what I've always done, where it's like, yeah, I've been awake for 10 minutes, let me set up this bar. And you know what? Yeah, once you get used to it, it's really not so bad.
Love the idea of like somebody just like peacefully sleeping in bed and just like just wakes up, rolls out of bed, immediately starts to like fill a bar well up with ice.
That's not far off from the truth, honestly. Like there's more than one shift where I've like literally been awake for 10 minutes before I got to the restaurant or the place I was bartending.
Oh yeah, because you live downtown, so you can just like walk straight to your work.
Yeah, zero commute. Like, and I think I've done that before on a Sunday where I just like straight up walk straight there. And those were like when I wake up early, I like walk, go get coffee.
you wake up, to the place. Walk to the bathroom, take a leak, walk downstairs, get coffee at the corner shop, keep walking in a straight line to the restaurant.
Yep, that's pretty much that's my life. But yeah, so now I'm finally kind of things are starting to level out a little bit. We had been wanting to restart this for a while, just kind of with Adam moving and then all the work garbage for me, and then like holidays happened, so we kind of took a bit of a break. But yeah, this should hopefully come out pretty close to when we record, like I think within a couple weeks or a month.
Yeah, it's another thing we want to change is to start uploading these sooner to when we record them.
Right, and then hopefully the new kind of set up the, you know, we don't have to think about a topic, we don't have to research or really delve into anything.
We know what we're going to be watching, and it's going to be the Tooth Fairy eventually.
Yeah, it's probably going to be bad. Like, I mean, we should do a tally at some point of how many of these movies we think are actually good. It's like, I feel like The Rock is one of those actors who, like, I kind of respect him, I like him every time I see him, but like it's like shotgun blasting.
He's like a more charismatic Nicolas Cage.
Whoa. Let's not talk shit about Nicolas Cage. Let's not.
No, it's not talking shit. It's to say that somebody is less charismatic than The Rock is not talking shit. That's like saying,
okay, you're right.
Like, hey, you're shorter than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Like, oh yes, thank you. I knew this.
The Rock is so charismatic, and I think most of the movies that fail that he's in are the ones that didn't realize how charismatic The Rock is. Like, he's so likable. It's ridiculous.
Man,
like, not quite as much as Brendan Fraser. We could talk about that later. But,
I actually have a theory that Brendan Fraser and The Rock, like, occupy the exact same area in Hollywood. And so, right as Brendan Fraser's star was waning, was when The Rock's star was, like, waxing. And I think those two things are correlated.
So you're saying,
like, if they made The Mummy and The Mummy Returns now, like, The Rock would... They did. They made Jungle Cruise.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that yet.
No, wait. They did. They made Jumanji. That is literally a role that Brendan Fraser would have had 10 to 20 years ago.
I mean, those are basically like the, what was the, Journey to the Center of the Earth movies?
Yeah.
Oh, that literally happened. No, that literally happened in those movies.
Yeah, they started with Brendan Fraser, and then they transitioned to The Rock. They occupy the exact same archetype in Hollywood.
My mind is blown.
Yeah, it should be.
Right. So, Adam, what have you been up to for the last year? What's been going on with you? How are you doing? How are you feeling? How are you doing?
Oh, okay. I'm doing good. What I've been up to for the last year is moving to Taiwan. Having a rough time with that. Because I did not have time to prepare for that during the pandemic.
Nope.
And so moved to Taiwan, had huge culture shock. Like, I've lived overseas before. I lived in Australia, lived in New Zealand. I was not prepared for the culture shock that would hit me when I moved to not just Taiwan, but Taipei. Like, fuck. I've lived in a big city before. I lived in Melbourne. Everyone would agree, yo, Melbourne, that's a big city. Nah. Taipei is like living on Coruscant. No shit. It really is.
That checks out.
Because it's the population of Melbourne, but with a quarter of the real estate, because Taipei is built in this bowl made by giant fucking mountains. So,
oh, wow. I didn't realize it was surrounded by mountains. That's super cool.
Yeah, it's like a whole city built inside of a crater. And so they got to the edge of the crater and then just started going up. And that's been going on for 100 years. So it is the most intense city I've ever lived in. And so I took a semester at a college to try to learn some Mandarin. And so, and so I got a little bit of that going on, but then other than that, I started working at a really cool bar called Ounce, which actually was one of the first bars in Taipei to make it onto the world's top 50 list back in 2016.
That's rad. Yeah, I'm super happy for you getting to work in a cool bar like that.
I'm really happy. This has like been one of my life goals, actually, is to work at a top 50 bar. And I'm really excited that I've gotten to do that. That being said, work here is really strange. It's not strange. It's slow. It's extremely slow because, one, there's no tourists, and two, because of COVID. So it is... some of the slowest bartending I've ever done, where it's mostly just like hanging out, and about a dozen people will come through the bar at any given time.
Yeah, that sounds exhausting, actually.
Yeah, it kind of is, but I'm also really, really tired from the past 2 years, so I'm okay bartending, but in like an extremely leisure pace.
And I mean, they pay hourly there, so it's not like you're making less money because you're less busy, basically.
That's true. That's the only way that this can work. And so, yeah, I'm getting paid hourly, and you know what? It's still the same top 50 bar program, and I get to talk to all these bartenders who were working there, like when they made it onto the list. And so it just has given me a chance to hang out, talk about drinks, and like make some good cocktails at a slower pace.
Right. That sounds pretty great, actually. Honestly, I wouldn't be mad about that. I feel like we have both generally agreed before that our favorite moments working at bars are almost always when you're just like in the thick of it and you're just like handling it easily. You're in the weeds and you're just chugging along and things are great. I don't know that those are some of my favorite moments when I'm bartending.
You're in the zone. Yeah,
you're in the zone. It's those, and then like the flip side when I'm like working at a nicer cocktail bar and I can just like carouse and like sit there and talk to people about like what drink I'm making them and like why I'm doing what I'm doing or like the history of the cocktail or you know why this drink is slightly different than the other thing that they were talking about. You know what I mean? Like, you know, getting to give people information.
I have this saying that I always like throw at customers that come in, and if they ever end up like talking to me about whiskey, and I have, you know, time, I'm not in the weeds, we're not in the zone, right, and they're just sitting in front of my station, and they order some nice whiskey, and they start asking me questions because they want to chat, and I just get to talk their ear off about whiskey, and every time they're about to leave, I always say like, hey, it was great serving you. Please come back. I enjoy people who enjoy good whiskey.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah. Honestly, like, some of my favorite interactions are always when I do get to talk. Like, I like telling people, or I like being able to educate people that don't know about stuff, or don't know about cocktails, or don't know about whiskey or gin or absinthe or whatever. But some of my favorite interactions are when people do know things. Like, I literally had, we have a bottle of soju. Or so, it's actually Sochu, because it's a Japanese-style whiskey. But I didn't even know that before this. We have a bottle of that at the new bar I'm working at. They just picked it up randomly as our starting, like liquor collection. And then I had a couple come in who knew more about it than I did. And they were asking me questions and, like, explaining to me the difference between Japanese Sochu and Korean Soju. And how the styles are very different, and they're commonly, like, misconstrued as, like, the same kind of thing, even though they're really not.
Oh,
like,
really?
They're just called the same. Yeah, they have the same, like, name, because, like, Japanese, it's soju sochu, if you're differentiating correctly, but the Korean style is more closer to whiskey from what they described to me, whereas the soju, or Sochu that we have is almost like a, it's like a barley wine almost. It's like somewhere between like a whiskey and a, like a sake slash barley wine. It's somewhere in there. Like, it's high, it's so, like 24% alcohol, but it's not a full whiskey.
I have had some education on this from working at a Japanese bar and restaurant in Nashville.
Right.
And I've always known that, Sochu is distilled. Like, the distinction between sake and sochu is that sake is brewed. It's like wine or beer.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's closer to a beer.
Sochu is distilled. So there's some sort of distillation process going on there.
Right.
But they only end up ever being ABV-wise, like alcohol by volume, about somewhere in the 20 to 30%. So
right.
Not like not
the one we have is 24%.
Yeah, they don't end up making it 40% or higher like a lot of liquors in the States.
Right. Well, I guess so, that demarcation that like everything's 40%, that standard in the States is pretty arbitrary. Like, we only started doing that in what, like the like post prohibition, I think, if even that. Like, it's actually
it is pretty arbitrary,
that.
But it's definitely a standard in the United States where if you're going to go get something that is liquor or hard, you're not going to find a vodka in the U.S. that's 37%.
No. Well, so there's a weird thing about that where I feel like that was more standardized in like the 80s and 90s, or like probably the 70s up, and now it's kind of... it's kind of backtracking a little bit, or well, the lines are getting blurred more because you have a lot of your bourbons in the States are going for your small batch, like single barrel, like batch proofing kind of stuff, where they're like, they're not like significantly higher in ABV, but they're like, you know, they're not sticking to 80, they're going to like 82 or like 90 or like 91, or you know, like they're
not
blurring the lines there.
Yeah,
and then you also have
barrel proof. When barrel proof, right, is if somebody just opens up a barrel that is aging spirit, like in this case what we're talking about is American whiskey, and they just pour it straight into the bottle, that liquid ends up being around 50 to 60% alcohol by volume.
Right.
But what Logan is talking about is a lot of craft distillers or even big brands that want to have that air of like craft are steering away from just always riding that 40% line, and things like Buffalo Trace Buffalo Trace is 45% ABV. Things and
that's,
that, like,
honestly, that one's probably, that's probably one of the biggest bourbons in the United States right now. Buffalo Trace is probably one of the biggest names, that or Maker's Mark. But I think Maker's Mark's a little bit higher too. But it's 46%.
Yeah, Maker's Mark isn't. Yeah, they're a little bit higher, so they're still diluted with water. They're still cut with water, but they're not cut down to the absolute line, like say Jim Beam would be.
Yeah, they're giving you a bit more bang for your buck usually. But on the other side of that, I feel like there's also this because flavored, and it's kind of, there's a weird history here because, like, I feel like it started being more of a thing with vodka in like the early 2000s and like late 90s. But you've got a lot of those flavored vodkas that have a lower ABV because they are added sugar or whatever else. They're not like a full liquor. They're marketing themselves more as a, like, you could drink this by itself, or you could drink this like maybe mixed with juice or something, pretty basically by itself. But a lot of those go down to like 35%. You know,
yeah, 35. Sometimes even if you get something like what's the coconut rum?
Malibu.
There's Malibu, and then Captain Morgan has a knockoff of it, and those are both like 25% alcohol by volume.
Oh, they're lower than that. Malibu is 21%, I think. It's a lot lower than you think it is. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. 21%. That's one of the reasons. Say what?
21%. I have a specific story about 21% alcohol by volume, but we'll come back to that in a second. The point I was going to get at is, I think a lot of those, like the, especially like the flavored vodkas, like Burnett's, like the like the really shitty flavored vodkas,
the bottom shelf flavored,
But even things like Pinnacle, which is a brand built entirely on, oh, we're going to have, you know, whipped cream and birthday cake flavored vodkas. Like,
yeah, we're
going to
have a flavor of everything you can think of.
Yeah. I think a lot of that, like, lower ABV is a cost-cutting.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, because the expensive part of a bottle is that alcohol.
Yeah.
That's the thing that takes a lot of energy and a lot of time and a lot of cost. So the more that you can cut that with fucking water out of the tap, the more
water, water and sugar. That's the other thing that usually gets added more often than not. Those are the two things they tend to add. Because, you know, I think I would have a better opinion of a lot of the flavored vodkas if they didn't add a lot of sugar to it, or if they stayed to 40% and they kept flavoring. So let's use this as a transition. Something I really, really enjoy is a good cold high noon.
Oh, is that what you're drinking right today. Now?
Yeah, because it's a nice, like, alcoholic seltzer that we're not sponsored, by the way. God, I wish we were, though. I know it's going to have more money than God by now. It's a really good flavored seltzer, good flavor, not a lot of sugar. Pretty low calorie. It's like 4.5% alcohol for a can, which is decent. That's like on a little higher than domestic beer levels.
I thought High Noon was zero calorie.
It's not zero calorie.
No. Oh, wait, no, it can't be zero calorie. There's alcohol in it, and alcohol is broken down as a sugar. Okay, yeah.
It sure is. Man, they're a tangent.
Yeah, but, heads up for anybody on a diet. alcohol, ethanol, is broken down in the body the exact same as sucralose and fructose, which is to say table sugar. So if you are on some sort of diet, a good way to imagine alcohol, say if you get a shot of whiskey that is 40% alcohol by volume, 40% of that is sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's what your body is going to basically treat it as.
Yeah, I don't know if it's 100% one-to-one, but basically my understanding is your liver basically converts it into sugar, and then your body...
Oh, yeah, right. Well, what ethanol is a poison, but we can digest it with our liver by turning it into sugar.
Yeah, that's basically how it works. So it's always really funny to me, like, all of the... you're still cutting out calories, but I feel like I get it a lot with, like, a lot of middle-aged white people where they're like, oh, I'm on a diet. I'm going to do a vodka soda with a lime instead. And it's like, well, Okay, well, you're not doing like a vodka Coke. You're not adding extra sugar into it. You're not doing a full cocktail, which probably has a lot more sugar in it than most other drinks.
Yeah,
that's
like if you got a Cosmo, like a vodka cocktail, you would have simple syrup and a lot more citrus. Mm-hmm. And
well, there's no simple syrup in a Cosmo.
Well, you would have cranberry juice, which is basically simple syrup.
Oh, hey. So at our academy for a minute there, we had this organic cranberry juice, which was really, really good because it didn't have that much added sugar.
Organic cranberry juice.
I had this problem where like people would ask me for Cosmos, so I had to literally readjust the recipe and add sugar to it because if I didn't, it would not taste good. Like, it just wouldn't taste like a Cosmo. So I literally had to put like a quarter ounce of like Demerara 2-to-1 like rich simple syrup to it every time I made one, just to get it to like taste like a normal Cosmo. I was trying to transition here. I'm sorry.
You are cutting out sugar by getting a vodka soda as opposed to a vodka and Coke or a Cosmo.
Right.
But
not by a lot.
It's really. Not. It's not. Like, that's why. Okay, so I am a vegetarian. Been vegetarian for like 10 years, mostly just because I really like the health benefits that I see in myself. And on top of that, I don't eat sugar. Like, I try really hard to not eat sugar. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to eat added sugar. I'll eat fruit, like bananas and peanut butter. Like, if I get peanut butter, I will specifically get the, you know, like the natural peanut butter, which just has like peanuts and salt. And
yeah,
in general,
I will say, anyone who hasn't switched to natural peanut butter, absolutely should. It's so much better.
Yeah, it just tastes better.
And
I just try to not eat sugar generally in my life. Don't never eat sweets or anything like that.
Oh, I love ice cream.
Because I've picked my vices, and my vice is cocktails. And so never change the ratio on any cocktail. If I want to have a drink, I'm just going to have a drink of whiskey. I'm going to make a daiquiri and throw in whatever amount of simple syrup is correct for that daiquiri. Because I will have sugar, but only in the form of cocktails.
Well, my thing on that is, like, I'm okay with it. I try to cut sugar out in casual diet. So, like, the things that I imbibe that have sugar are, like, cocktails that I really enjoy. You know, like, things that I'm going to get pleasure out of, enjoyment out of. I'm not going to sit there and drink a Coke for every meal. Because, like, you know, every once in a while, I might have some Coke. I cannot tell you the last time I bought a soda. Like, an actual soda. I do some drink energy drinks.
Over 10 years for me.
I drink energy drinks, but it's because I'm a garbage person.
I also don't drink caffeine or smoke cigarettes.
You're basically Amish. Like, fuck. Yeah. I drink a lot of caffeine generally, but even with that, like, I have tried to switch to, like, I almost exclusively drink sugar-free if I can get anything, which there's things that are up and down about, like, sugar alternatives, but most of them aren't actually very bad for you. It's really just, like, a way to trick your body because it tastes sweet, but your body actually can't process it. So what you're basically doing is just going through your system. So,
yeah.
It's fine.
Oh, okay. So you had some sort of point that you were trying to make like a million years ago when you were talking
about. What I was trying to do is this transition to what we're drinking today. Adam, what are you drinking?
Oh, yeah. Man, all right. I do have to say that this is a unusual episode of our podcast because usually it's like, hey, this is us. How you doing? How you doing? What are you drinking? What are you drinking? And we're almost, we're over 30 minutes into the podcast before we got to what we're drinking. It's just because we haven't done this in a long time, so
it's almost like we haven't done this in a year.
It's not that we're not good at what we're doing, we're just very excited. So we're going off on tangents and chatting and just hanging out.
We're just excited to be hanging. So what are you drinking?
So much to the point where I have finished the drink I made to start recording this podcast with.
That's fantastic. Well, what was it? Let's talk
what
about
was
that.
It? The thing that I was drinking was a fucked up Sazerac.
Oh.
No, not fucked up in a bad way. Specifically altered.
Oh, okay.
So, it was a Sazerac. A Sazerac is a a very classic cocktail that got its start in the New Orleans area. It's basically a old-fashioned with a bunch of twists added in.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's the best way to describe it. I was talking to a coworker of mine because I was trying to explain to her what a Sazerac was, and I was like, "Yeah, it's basically an old fashioned, but you
could just call it a New Orleans old fashioned, and no one would get on you for that."
More or less, I don't know.
So how you make a Sazerac is you take a nice cold glass. Hopefully, you pull it out of a freezer or something. Mm-hmm. And you rinse that with absinthe, either by putting a few mils of absinthe in there and swirling it around, or what I like to do and a lot of good bars like to do is take a little atomizer, little like spray things mm-hmm. that we're all very familiar with from having to spray alcohol on our hands everywhere. you fill that full of absinthe and you spray that into your glass and you just like marinate or coat. You flavor your glass with absinthe, which is a very anise, fennel, black licorice style tasting thing.
It's a very pungent flavor.
And then other than that, you just make an old fashioned with a rye whiskey instead of bourbon. Mm-hmm. Simple syrup still. A lot of people tend to like more brown simple syrups for a Sazerac.
Like a Demerara or
like a Demerara, Turbinado. Yeah. Maybe even like a brown sugar simple. I should try that sometime.
I've had brown sugar simples before. They're pretty good, generally.
Instead of using Angostura and orange bitters like you would with with an old-fashioned, you mm-hmm. use just a shit ton of Peychaud's, which mm-hmm. is the bitter in New Orleans. So it ends up just coming out like an old-fashioned that you made with rye, Peychaud's, and you just give it a little kiss with absinthe. The one other strange thing about Sazeracs is the glass that it's served in, which is very specific. You serve a Sazerac in a rocks glass, a tumbler, something that you would have an old fashioned in, but specifically no ice. You don't serve a Sazerac with ice. And usually if you take out ice, you want to be serving it up in some sort of stemmed ware, right. A Nicanora, a coupe, a martini glass. You do that with whiskey drinks like Rob Roy's and Manhattan's. Mm-hmm. Basically anything that doesn't have ice in it, you like throw it in some sort of stemware so that it's up and the booze is closer to your face. But for some reason, Sazeracs have this traditional like presentation that everyone decides that we are going to go ahead and follow, and it's to have it in a tumbler, but without ice.
I'm gonna be honest.
That's not to say that you don't dilute it. You build it and you stir it down. You just pour it off of the ice into a glass.
Dilution is so fucking important, and it took me uncomfortably long to know that as a bartender. That like
really.
The amount of water that you're adding is very important. Like I was probably bartending for at least a year before I even like thought about that as a concept. Like I just thought, oh, I'm making it cold. That's all I'm doing. I wasn't thinking about
the water
that you're adding. Yeah.
And dilution is super important.
Yeah. The first time I was really thinking about that was with when I was making a batch cocktail for the first time, and I was like, oh, well, how will I make this at a bigger scale? I'm like, oh, well, I need to add water to this at a certain amount, otherwise it's not gonna come out right. Unless I'm planning
it would not be the equivalent of the drink that you make in the moment, because if you're making a daiquiri, you're going to shake it with ice. If you're going to make a Sazerac, you're going to stir it over ice, and the only way that something can become cold if you're using ice is for that ice to melt and become water. It has to give up some of that cold energy and transition from a solid to a liquid. But in doing so, you also put a bunch of water into your drink.
Yeah, just by nature of how that physics work.
There's a really popular bar book I'm sure we're going to reference a lot called Liquid Intelligence. Probably. And he has a big section on ice. And a rule of thumb that he has is there is no chilling without dilution. And there is no dilution without chilling while working with ice.
Yeah, that's just the nature of how it's going to work.
Yeah, like that water is super important. Like you said, you were making a batch cocktail, which is a batch cocktail is exactly what it says on the tin. It's a big batch of one cocktail. So if you're going to make an old-fashioned, instead of just pouring 2 ounces of bourbon, you pour the entire bottle of bourbon into some sort of big bucket, and then you just scale up all the rest of the ingredients proportionately. But
exactly
one of those ingredients is water. And so I fucking hate it when people this hasn't happened to me in a long time because I work at nice cocktail bars, but when people ask for less ice in, say, a gin and tonic.
It drives me crazy.
That you don't get more alcohol.
It's the same thing with, like, I think this is a thing that people have picked up from, like, ordering at, like, restaurants or, like... Well, there's some people who order no ice for their drinks for other reasons.
The people who order no ice, less it's different. Ice.
Yeah, less ice.
Less ice. It's like, no, that's not doing the thing. If you're getting a Mountain Dew and you say, hey, can I get a Mountain Dew with just a little bit of ice? You're going to have more Mountain Dew in that...
For sure.
In that cup. If you ask for a gin and tonic and you say, hey, only a little bit of ice, what you're going to get is the exact same amount of gin and a lot more tonic.
The other one that bothers me a lot is that there are a lot of people who don't understand the difference between a double and a tall. Because I've realized this because I will ask people a lot, and usually with like gin and tonics or a lot of like seltzer, like alcohol combos, because a lot of people like to drink them tall. I will ask, oh, do you want that short or do you want that tall? And they'll say, oh, short's fine, because they think that I'm offering them a double, and I'm not offering them a double. And I'll have the exact reverse where I have people who I know for sure are trying to ask me for a double, but they're like, oh yeah, I'm trying to catch up. Can I get that tall? And it's like, You're not getting any more alcohol, but it's not how that works.
That's not the thing that you're asking for. If anything, getting it tall means that the drink in your hand has a lower alcohol by volume.
Generally,
because there's more dilution, there's more additives, there's more soda water, there's more tonic.
I'm not going to lie. Yeah. The majority of bars that I've worked in, their Collins glasses have been almost the same size as their Rocks glasses. So actually, I feel like more often than not,
that's the secret.
Just the same.
That's the secret is that... they're actually the correct way is to have them be the exact same volume,
right?
And like, if you want a small thing in a small glass, you get a coupe.
That's the secret. Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, I am drinking, as I've already kind of established, a High Noon peach flavor, because I actually do really enjoy them. They're really nice. It's kind of helped me drink a little less beer than I usually do, which has been cool. They're only like 100 calories each. And the flavor, the biggest thing, I've had a lot of fucking flavored seltzers or like whatever bullshit that Bud Light or Mick Ultra is trying to push out that's like a flavored not beer. And High Noon is the only one that I've had that is consistently just a good, it just tastes good. It has a good flavor. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how they get their flavor. I don't know who's doing their flavoring, who's developing their flavors, but they are all just great. Like, even the ones I like the least, which is like watermelon flavor, which just tastes like watermelon candy almost. It's still fine. Like, I don't like it, but it's not gross tasting. Whereas, like, I don't know, even what's the other big one? Like, Truly.
Oh, yeah, like Truly or something. Yeah, something like that.
Like, there's a bunch of other brands that are super popular, but, like, Truly's are... They taste awful. They taste
What's the one that started... White Claw. White Claw is the brand that started it.
White Claw, man, also terrible.
I don't like any flavor of White Claw other than mango. All the other flavors...
Mango's fine.
The mango's fine. All the other flavors, not great.
Well, the big thing is they all taste like... They all taste like a fake sugary... They have like a fake sugary kind of component. They taste fake.
Yeah, it tastes like you took a bunch of... Oh, okay, I know. Have you ever had Runts? That candy Runts?
Yes, I have.
And they're shaped like fruits, and then they are purportedly flavored like those fruits. but they're really not. They're like sugary and gross. It's as if you like separated out a package of Runtz and dissolved like all the banana ones and all the apple ones in individual bottles of vodka, and then made vodka sodas with those.
Yeah, that's the thing is they taste fake in a way that it's hard to describe. I will test anyone. Go get you whatever flavor of High Noon and get the comparable flavor of whatever else seltzer you want, like hard seltzer, hard whatever. I don't know if they usually call themselves that, like whatever flavored not beer thing. Taste them back to back and you will be able to tell the difference. I don't know, like High Noon's just they taste crisp. They taste, I don't know, they have sugar in them, obviously. They have some kind of flavoring component. They have alcohol. But they don't taste sugary. They just taste like a flavored soda with, there's that sugar in it, I know that.
It tastes like you threw a shot of vodka in a LaCroix.
Right, exactly. Yeah, pretty close. But actually, I like LaCroix actually a lot too, but the flavor of High Noons are better than LaCroix, probably because they add sugar, more than likely. No, but it blows my mind how like I've tried a bunch of different brands of these and I thought they were all garbage until I tried High Noons. And High Noons, I'm like, you know what? I fuck with that because sometimes I just want something really light to drink that's like an easy drinking thing that's not a beer. Beer sits really heavy. It just does.
Beer is literally the entire point of beer from time immemorial was to get as many calories into you as possible.
Yeah, because with booze.
It is liquid bread.
It is liquid bread.
And the point of beer is to be, like, calorically dense.
Mm-hmm. There's a German beer that's, I think it's Doppelbock. I think Doppelbock, maybe. There's one of the German beers.
Quick, you gotta break through the matrix and figure it out.
Yeah, I'm gonna look it up online.
What's the literal translation?
Yeah, it's a Bock beer. A Bock beer is literally German for liquid bread.
Which is exactly what it is. Like, in medieval times, all the peasantry survived on bacon, bread, and beer. And that's pretty much it. So if you're looking for something, if you're looking to get your groove on and like steering towards low calorie, just stop drinking beer.
Beer's very high calorie.
Drink literally like whiskey soda instead. Like you'll get drunk and it will be less calories. Or like Logan, like High Noon. So hey, High Noon, if you're looking for a weird place to spend some marketing money, no need to contact us because we've already plugged the shit out of your product. So.
Look, all I'm saying is I will plug you harder and I will work the shaft if you support us.
So I wanted to talk to you about how I fucked up my Sazerac.
Oh, yeah. How did you fuck it up?
So I didn't fuck it up unintentionally. I fucked it up intentionally, which is just making choices. So one thing... I kept the ice in the glass.
Right. Because... So just closer to a basic old fashion, which just makes sense to me. But yeah.
And two, I used bourbon.
I traditionally, like, almost always prefer rye in any cocktail. Like, literally, I don't know that you could give me a whiskey cocktail that uses bourbon traditionally that I wouldn't just tell you straight to your face is better with rye. Like whiskey sours, for sure, better with rye. Old fashions, better with rye. Manhattans traditionally should be rye anyway, but a lot of people do bourbon, and definitely better with rye. I don't know, I'm a big rye fanboy, I guess, but I just feel like I've had them all back to back, and unless the bourbon is just really, really exceptional, rye's just better. Like, it just tastes better.
Man, okay, so I think I'm definitely the opposite. I think in general, I prefer a bourbon to, like, a rye. Mm. Let's level the playing field and just say, like, Buffalo Trace and Rittenhouse Rye.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, I think, are comparable. You'll find them, like, next to each other on a speed rail at a bar.
They're about the same price point.
So. Yeah, if you're going to make a... whiskey sour with one of those, Man, okay, now that I think about it, I actually don't know. Because there is a lot more flavor and punch in Rittenhouse.
That's what I'm telling you, man. Any rye, in cocktails. Like, the only one that I kind of hedge on is like an Old Fashioned. So I think an Old Fashioned, a bourbon can really stand up and kind of be present in almost every other cocktail I've had. If I swap that bourbon for rye, that rye is going to stand up to the other ingredients a lot better.
You know what? I think you're persuading me. Except for, right, Old Fashioned, which I believe that only an Old Fashioned not only is like a great bourbon cocktail, but I think that that is the way in which you should drink bourbon in general. Like, if you're going to drink like a nice scotch, go ahead, have it on a like a whiskey soda, like a whiskey highball, or just neat, or make it into a Rob Roy. You know, there's lots of good ways to enjoy scotch. If you're going to drink a bourbon, I don't think you should even drink it neat. I think what you should drink it as first, if you want to get to know this bourbon, is in an Old Fashioned.
I could definitely see that. Yeah. It kind of, it mellows it out a little bit, but you still get a lot of the flavor out of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I will put, like, if I make a Old Fashioned for myself, I usually do rye. That's just because I'm going to buy one bottle of whiskey for my house use that's not like a higher end. And it's usually going to be Rittenhouse rye. Because it's 100 proof, bottle and bond, $25 a bottle.
Can't beat that.
I can use it for everything, too. So it's like any whiskey cocktail I want, I'm like, I'm going to use it.
All right, so hold on. Fine. Let me ask you this question. Let me put you through this trial. If you had to choose to make a Sazerac with Rittenhouse rye or a Sazerac with Eagle Rare bourbon, which one would you choose?
Man, I haven't had Eagle Rare in a minute. Eagle Rare is really good, though.
Okay, now hold on. Let me throw this in. If you had to go buy one of those two bottles, but the Eagle Rare was about $3 cheaper than the Rittenhouse rye, then one would you use?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Because Eagle Rare is, what, like almost twice the price of a bottle of Rittenhouse rye, I think?
Yeah.
It's pretty close, yeah.
Okay, so that's the choice that I was met with in Taipei, which is this liquor store, the closest liquor store near me. Oh, man, liquor prices in Taipei are, I'm not going to say weird or different. They're just, they're different. They're not weird or strange. They're different than anywhere else I've been in the world to a larger extent than anywhere else I've been in the world. You know, I lived in New Zealand, and it was more expensive to buy American whiskey than it was to buy Scottish whiskey. But, you know, not crazy. In Taipei, they're playing fucking Calvin ball over here. Like, so there's a bottle of Eagle Rare for like the equivalent of about $30 USD at this liquor store. And then right next to it is a bottle of Rittenhouse Rye for the equivalent of about $35 USD.
That's, and so I'm weird.
Like, why would I do anything? And also that bottle of Eagle Rare, like, and then there's a bottle of like Diplomatico rum, a really good rum, but it is the same price as this bottle of Eagle Rare. And I'm just like, why? These bottles of Eagle Rare at this liquor store are crazy undercosted. And so
why would
I buy anything else?
I'm going to argue that it's probably actually the opposite. I bet you money that Eagle Rare is actually overcosted in the States just because of how big bourbon has gotten in the last like 10 years.
You know what? I guarantee can totally see that.
Because everyone and their fucking mother in the U.S., like bourbon is good. I like bourbon. I've worked at a bourbon bar. I've had a lot of bourbon. It's very enjoyable liquor. You know, there's a lot more to explore. And there's a lot of things that I like way better than even the best bourbon that I've had. Like, even the most expensive bourbon I've ever had, I could pick out two or three ryes or two or three scotches or at least, or probably more, even more rum that I like substantially more. That is just a more enjoyable experience and is cheaper. So I just don't know why anyone cares that much. I don't know. Well, it's a marketing thing, almost definitely, but, you know, it's just...
Yeah, it's a marketing thing.
how it goes. Oh, but so the other cocktail, by the way, that I have. Well, so I have a High Noon because that's my sipper. I started that. This is actually my shower beer. As I shower, I'm kind of finishing that right now. But I decided to make a cocktail for the podcast because I wanted to. And I've got a Rittenhouse Rye Old Manhattan. That's what I've got.
Mm.
Did a couple dashes of Angostura bitters, a couple dashes of orange bitters by, I think I did the it's Fee Brothers because it's just the easiest one for me to get. And I had to garnish with a lemon peel this time, which I don't think is quite as good. Normally I do orange.
Orange peel, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't pick up oranges the last time I was in town or in the grocery store, so I've got lemons right now because I had a lot of gin, so I'm like, well, I'll buy lemons because usually my go-to gin drink is like, I usually just drink gin, rocks, Angostura bitters, lemon peel expression, and that's like peak goodness for me. But you pick a good gin. But so I'm just kind of working with the citrus that I have, but it turned out pretty good. Oh, I'm also using so I did Rittenhouse, and then the sweet vermouth I'm using right now is Nolly Prot, which is, I don't know, not one I picked because I like it. I'm actually just picking a bunch of different vermouths now to try different ones.
Oh, just to get a feel? Because you know what you know the ones you like.
Well, I know what my favorite is, and it's Cokie Torino.
Cokie Torino, yeah.
It's the best one, but unfortunately, the liquor store I usually go to has been out of it for the last 2 months, so I'm going to have to try to find it somewhere else.
A whole lot of bartenders like Carpano.
Antica.
Oh, Antica, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a good vermouth.
It's really good.
But I think it is just a bit too flavorful and definitely a bit too expensive.
Yeah.
When you can get something like Cokie Torino.
My thing is, I think we've talked about this before.
Maybe it was just personal. That sneeze snuck up on me. Oh, I did not expect that. Oh, that was very surprising.
Don't do that. don't do surprise sneezes. That's a terrible idea. No, I think Carpano Antica, a lot of people use it for Manhattans, and I don't think you should use it for Manhattan. You know what I think it's really fucking good in is a Negroni, because it is one of the few vermouths that I think can really stand up and like
to Campari,
go toe-to-toe with Campari. And if you do an Antica Negroni, you probably don't have to readjust your ratio, because I've always thought, generally, I always pull down my Campari a little bit. I always go more for like a Boulevardier build, where I up my gin a little bit and pull down my Campari and my sweet vermouth, just because, I don't know, Campari is just so aggressive.
Campari is super aggressive. Honestly, like, yeah. I do not get people who like classic Negronis, where it's 1 ounce of gin, 1 ounce of sweet vermouth, and 1 ounce of Campari. It's like, that gin is not doing any. You might as well put a vodka there.
Yep, I would agree. Like, it's just totally lost. Like, it just... Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense for the history of that, because the history of that is that it started as an Americano, and somebody asked for it to be boozier, and this was like in the... Like mid 1800s or
no, early 1900s? It was specifically the year 1919.
1919. But anyway, vodka would not have been common to use around that time, because I don't think vodka really got popular until the 50s, the 40s even. It was not a very common liquor for most bars to have.
And it's only actually become popular in the U.S., really. Other places like here in Taiwan, gin and scotch are still super dominant.
Well, gin's just been like the most popular liquor for the majority of history, generally. Yeah. Which, I mean, is good, because gin is fantastic to work with in cocktails, and it's also good by itself, which is probably my favorite liquor. I don't know. Rum's coming up there. There's a lot of really good rum right now. There's a lot of really good rum you can have. But I don't know.
But
yeah, like, no, it makes sense that gin was the choice at the time. But yeah, vodka, if you want a proofed up Americano, pick a vodka or, I don't know, something that'll stand up to your Campari.
Yeah, the only success I've had with making Negronis with that 1-1-1 ratio is using a Navy Strength gin. So a gin that is specifically labeled as Navy Strength, which means it's going to be 57%. Mm-hmm. So it's going to have a lot more punch and flavor.
Yeah.
Just because there's more of the alcohol, which carries more of the like flavoring components, the juniper and other botanicals in it.
Right.
As opposed it's to the be a bit rest of the bottle, which is, you know, unflavored water. So you just have a larger percentage of flavor in that bottle.
Right. And that just makes sense, generally.
Yeah. The other way I found that to make a good Negroni with those ratios is to use mezcal instead of gin.
You know, I had that thought just now where I'm like, huh, what else would I replace it with? And I'm like, mezcal.
Yeah,
And it's sending with, we've talked about this for last words before. Last words are almost objectively better with mezcal.
Last word is another great classic cocktail. It's a club style, so it's equal parts of four ingredients. Mm. It's gin, maraschino liqueur, almost always Luxardo brand maraschino liqueur.
I have a hard time replacing that one.
Yeah, there's no replace. It's a very specific cocktail because it has gin, maraschino, green chartreuse, and lime. Mm-hmm. Gin, you can use any gin you want. Lime is lime. But that Luxardo maraschino liqueur, there's no other like maraschino or cherry flavored liqueur that is going to beat Luxardo's.
Not really.
And green chartreuse is a singular entity. It is the category and the only one in the category.
There's a local bar here that has something that they use instead of yellow and green chartreuse. I forget what the brand is, but it's kind of comparable.
I mean, you can use vegetal genipe instead of green chartreuse.
And I think that's what they're basically using.
You can
forget the brand is, but
Strega instead of yellow chartreuse.
Yeah.
But
it's almost like chartreuse has been passed down orally by Chartreusian monks since the like 1500s. There's no way to copy that.
It's green chartreuse. The funny thing is that green chartreuse isn't called green chartreuse. It's just called chartreuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a liquor that is so old that the color chartreuse is named after the liquor.
Yep. Which is fantastic. Which is why it's yellow chartreuse, because it's a very distinct variation.
Yeah. But yeah, like anyway, chartreuse is made by monks in France, and it's been made at this abbey in France since the 1600s, and they don't write down the recipe. And the recipe is they take a bunch of botanicals from somewhere, usually around France, and they infuse it into this booze, and then it comes out green, and it's like 55%, and and they don't write it down because they just whisper it to each other in the monastery. But what that also means is that chartreuse changes over time,
mm-hmm.
because as
there's no way for it not to. Yeah, it's like playing a game of telephone over 500 years.
It's not only just playing a game of telephone, but it's playing a game of telephone in France for 400 years between 1600 and 2000. And I don't know if you know this, a lot of history has taken place in that general vicinity.
No way. Huh. Really,
so
in France?
Sometimes, yes. So sometimes there just wouldn't be any more of this ingredient, but the monks are just going to keep making chartreuse.
Right.
So if you have a super old, like 70-year-old bottle of chartreuse, something around World War II or before or just after World War II, it is going to taste significantly different than a bottle that you went and bought at the store today.
So I'm wondering, like, it's a very sugary liquor. Like,
oh yeah, that's true. It is also very sugary.
I don't think it might technically still be a liqueur, because I think the definition of liqueur is that you add sugar into a liquor. But it's 55% alcohol.
Yeah, which is pretty intense.
Yeah, so that means that they're starting with a very high proof, but they add a lot of sugar to it, because, like, I mean, if anyone that's had a bottle of green chartreuse or dealt with it, like, the cap gets super crystallized, like, just from...
Yeah.
That shit's sugary. Like, and it's one of those weird things where it's, like, green chartreuse is very herbal, It's got some bitter components to it, but it's also sweet. And I feel like that's like a, I don't know, if you're not used to, you don't have a palate developed for it, it'll just come off as vegetal and sweet, or vegetal and bitter, and you will not really notice the sweetness as much. So I've noticed this with like a couple of other Amaros, like people that I've had try them will only taste bitter. That's all they'll get off of it. They'll taste bitter.
If you give somebody a shot of Averna or or Fernet,
yeah,
they'll be saying, oh man, this is so bitter. But even Campari has a lot of sugar.
Campari has so much sugar in it. That's ridiculous. But it's super bitter still. There's like, those are, I think it's that weird, there's this mentality that maybe it could be just like a Western thing. I don't know. It might be cultural, but it's obviously
mentality that bitter is the opposite of sweet.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
And no, and those are, yeah, they can exist at the same time. Those are two distinct tastes. Like ketchup is sweet, but it's also very umami.
Yeah. Well, flavors, it's got a lot of vinegar in it. It's got
cardinal flavors, things that you pick up with your tongue and not your sense of smell. None of those cancel each other out. So they can balance, but they don't cancel out. So you can have something that is bitter and sweet and sour.
Mm-hmm. All totally possible. They'll just kind of exist on the same plane. Yeah, you want it to balance. You're not trying to cover one up with the other. Although I do find that with certain kind of like really astringent like flavors, you can kind of cover it up with bitter with sugary qualities. But you can do the same thing with sour. So like if you make something sour enough, it'll probably cover up the bitterness to a level. Not as well, I feel like. I feel like there, it's probably some kind of matrix that you could build.
It's more like you're working with volumes. Like, what I mean when I say that is sound volume. Right. So you can make something, you can make the bitterness in Campari, the bitterness is very loud. But that is just drowning out the fact that there is still a really high volume of sweet. And if you can get your palate accustomed to the bitterness, you can hold it in your mouth, feel it on your palate, swallow it, and pick out the sweetness to it.
Right.
It's kind of just pick up those usually when somebody tries it for the very first time, all they get is bitter, and then they stop thinking past that.
Right. I would agree with that. It's almost like a frequency almost, where you can, when you're dialing cocktails, you're trying to match that together almost. That makes any sense. Where you're trying to overlap them in a way.
It's like a cocktail is like a choir.
Yeah,
with a bunch of different tastes and notes, and you're trying to make everything.
They don't need to overlap, but they need to like
harmonize,
be in unison with each other. Yeah. Would agree with that. Well,
speaking of making cocktails.
Yeah, we have been talking for a minute, and we should make a cocktail based on this movie, or talk about this movie. Do we want to talk about this movie?
I don't know. We talked about it a little bit right up front, and I think that's all that really bears repeating is like, well, The Rock is pretty charming. He's very similar to Brendan Fraser, where he slots in, and I think it's really fitting that the first film that The Rock is, you know, a title credit of, is actually secretly a Brendan, well, not secretly, is a Brendan
is
Fraser
just
film.
A Brendan Fraser movie, yeah. This is a really weird movie, because it's like, it's weird on so many levels, because the first Mummy movie, we've agreed with this, I'm sure we will talk about it explicitly at some point, is a very good movie by itself, no addendums.
It's a fun romp.
It's a fun romp with good actors that all have good chemistry, and it's a tight movie. Like, that movie knows what it's doing, it knows what all of its characters are. That script was probably written for years before it was actually made. Like, somebody lovingly fine-tuned that movie. And Mummy Returns feels like somebody was given a bunch of money shoved in their face and was like, hey, make a sequel to this. And they cranked it out in like 6 months?
Yes.
That's what it feels like. And yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
It's entertaining.
Yeah.
It's definitely entertaining.
To a degree, like the action scenes are pretty good. The CG is mostly bad.
CG is early 2000s CG. And you said that they had a pretty big budget for this movie?
They did.
That was probably to its detriment because they put a bunch of early CG. This is prequels era CG. And they put a bunch of it in there.
Yeah, this came out around the same time. Because I think the first Mummy movie was benefited by the fact that it probably was in production before any of the Star Wars prequels came out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we talked about this on one of the other podcasts, but there is a definitive line in movie history where the prequels came out, they made a fuck ton of money, and they were all CG. And honestly, I will stand by. I don't like the Star Wars prequel trilogy for much. Mostly, the CG is pretty good.
It holds up.
It holds up decently.
I recently watched a couple of the prequel movies, and it's getting to the point where it has that uncanny valley thing happening.
Yeah, but they do this thing where they know how to use it, where it's they're always using it for like aliens and stuff, you know, like if they can,
yeah,
you know, if they can do things in practical effects, they do. But the things that they do in CGI are so not human that it works.
It
generally,
yeah, you can definitely tell that like Hayden Christensen is fighting a drawing of a cat in in the Clone Wars.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's okay. It gets the point across.
It's mostly fine. The biggest thing on those movies is it's so awkward on how the actors are interacting because they don't know how to, you know.
No, because they're in the middle of an ocean of green screen.
Yes, they have nothing to play off of.
It's not, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, my point is there is a distinct period in that like early 2000s where the prequels came out and were just so popular, made so much fucking money, and used so much CG that like everything after that that was made after that movie came out decided, oh, hey, yeah, we can do that. That's easy. Like, we don't have to put that much work into like props and like costume and whatever, we'll just CG it later, it's fine.
Let's just make the Rock into a scorpion centaur.
Yeah, or like the Scooby-Doo movie, the first one, which I don't think is a terrible movie. Actually, I think the second one is legitimately good, but the first Scooby-Doo movie, they're just like, yeah, we'll just CG Scooby the whole time, it'll be fine, and we'll CG all the monsters, it'll be fine. And it's not fine. It's never fine.
Man, The Rock scorpion monster at the end of this movie.
So bad.
That is some really bad CGI.
He looks like a bad video game version of The Rock. Like, I played some of the WWE like video games came out around this time, and like I'm pretty sure they looked better than this does.
It's not great.
It's not good.
And that's one of only two scenes that The Rock is in this movie, despite getting billed fourth.
Yeah, there's like a whole opening thing, which is like super weird, because it's like you don't get any of the main characters yet. They literally just cold open into, this is the Scorpion King, this is his backstory, here's The Rock, he's doing stuff, he doesn't have a single spoken line. I think he like yells.
He yells in Egyptian, but also in a very heavy American accent, because he was not a good actor at this point.
No, he's not.
But that, yes, is his only line, just yelling in Egyptian.
There's all those CG, like, Anubis warriors, and they're just not good. They're really not good. Like, honestly, they look better than most things in this movie, but they still don't look great.
So, as our first cocktail for Cocktail Conceit Season 2 on the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to make based off of The Mummy Returns?
So here's the question. Are we making this based on the whole movie? Are we making this based on only the parts of the movie The Rock is in?
You know what? This is Cocktail Conceit on the rocks.
On the rocks.
I think we should only pay attention to the opening and the ending Scorpion fight scene.
He's only in like maybe 10 minutes of this movie. Like maybe.
And this movie is like 2 hours long.
Yeah, it's way too long. Like, I always think about this movie and I'm like, oh yeah, it's a tight 90 minutes. And I'm like, no, it's not. Nope.
You can just cut off the first 5-10 minutes of the Rock's backstory and just start on... You don't need it. You can just start on the first scene with Brendan Fraser. And yeah. I'm pretty sure that's how the movie was supposed to start.
Probably, yeah. Like, definitely it seems like that. Oh, yeah, I don't know. It's... There's a whole... They give Brendan Fraser so many one-liners in this movie, it's ridiculous. I was literally trying to count it on my hand at one point, and I lost track. Because it's... He doesn't have actual lines. He just has one-liners.
I noticed that, too. There's a point where their child has been kidnapped. Yep. And they are seeking a way to go after the kid. And Brendan Fraser's character is in no way concerned or distressed. He is just quippy as ever.
Yep.
This is a movie that feels like Joss Whedon went back in time after having great success on the first Avengers movie and wrote this movie.
Yep.
Or at least it's just punched up Brendan Fraser's parts.
So many quips. There's so many quips.
He is a Joss Whedon quip robot.
Yeah. And it's all Brendan Fraser, and then there's a couple that the mummy character gets, like one or two, but they're all in Egyptian, so like, yeah. And there's Jonathan gets one or two, and the curator Evie. Guy.
Oh, the curator. I'm pretty sure that's what he's titled as.
Yeah, but his secondhand guy, his name's like Loch Nah or something weird. He's got a couple that are really funny because he's playing off the kid most of the movie. Which I might have watched a whole movie of just that. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, man. I couldn't stand any moment where that kid was on screen because...
I didn't mind him when he was with Loch Nah. When he was with Loch Nah and then the crazy chick who wants to be the mummy's bride. It literally, if you had a whole movie where it was just the three of them by themselves, I would watch that. I would watch that for sure.
I will say, the kid seems almost in contempt of the danger that he's in at all times.
All times. It's never taken seriously whatsoever.
But if we take into consideration that he is the son of Brendan Fraser in this movie,
yep,
he is his father's son, which is to say, completely disregarding the danger he is in and only quipping. He is a tiny Brendan Fraser through this entire movie.
He's the tiny little quip machine.
Tiny little quip machine, yeah. With no regard to whatever danger he's in. People are literally threatening him with knives in front of him, and he does not care. He is just going to quip.
I'll defend this because obviously there's a time jump. They imply several times that... Brendan Fraser and what's her name? Evie. Well, her character's name is Evie. What's her it's the actress's name. I can't remember her
name. I have no idea.
It's like, is it Rachel Weisz?
Oh, yeah, it is Rachel Weisz.
Okay, yeah. Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz's characters, Evie and O'Connell. I don't remember his first name. It doesn't matter. It is implied heavily that they've been just tooling around, stealing shit from mummy tombs for the last, like, 10 years. And they bring their kid with them, so like I guess this kid's seen some shit. Like, I don't know. I there were two things that I was keeping a track on. It was how many times Brendan Fraser did one-liners, and then also how many times they made offhand references to the last movie as a joke. It was like, oh hey, remember that thing that happened? Hey, remember that last movie we did?
Was that a lot?
It was a lot. It's it's at least like 5 times in the first like 15 minutes. And then they do it more throughout the rest of the movie. It's like this is callback of the movie.
Sure. Hey, remember that movie that we made that was really popular?
Yeah, you remember?
And then
remember there was a mummy in it?
People go, "Oh yeah, I remember that." And then they don't have a point after that. They're just saying, hey, remember that? And people go, that's yeah. And they're like, yeah, that's so the whole thing.
Well, yeah, it's like, yeah.
All right, well, so what kind of drink can we make inspired by this? We talked a lot about bourbon and whiskey and a bit about gin this episode.
Yeah, we did.
A brief divergent into like Sochu and ABV.
Yeah, and a little bit into chartreuse and last words into Negronis.
Is there any way you can combine chartreuse and whiskey?
Maybe if you do yellow, actually.
Yellow chartreuse.
I think yellow chartreuse would pair better generally.
I think maybe that's just a bad idea.
Maybe. It could definitely be a bad idea. I mean, there's a last word variant that uses whiskey. It's
Paper Plane?
Oh, man. The Paper Plane. Yeah, Paper Plane is bourbon, yellow chartreuse, Aperol,
lemon juice. You know what? Yeah, that does have yellow chartreuse.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
we didn't think of that. It's a great cocktail, but we didn't think of that one, unfortunately.
We sure didn't. I mean, we could play off of that, though. We could play off of... We could do a last word build.
We talked a lot about spirit forward drinks and a lot about rye.
Mm-hmm.
What if we made something with rye, spirit forward, and we used yellow chartreuse as a small modifier?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could do that. Generally, I mean, it's fairly sweet. You could almost do a
What if we do a Daisy style build with rye whiskey and yellow chartreuse?
Okay, probably lemon juice.
Lemon juice, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'm not mad about this so far. That's a good base, but I feel like I want to get some Mummy Returns in here. I feel like we don't have any don't got any theming in here. You know what I mean? Like this is what we talked about. I'm not mad about it, but we got a full 10 minutes of The Rock in this movie, and we really need to really need to pull that in. So we got some scorpions. Yeah, a lot of sand.
Well, okay, sand, yellow.
Yeah.
All right.
There's that whole oasis place at the end that's all, like, vegetal.
Okay. Well, vegetal, chartreuse.
Yeah, we got that. Okay, you're right. Okay, yeah.
All right. What if we throw an egg white into it? Because egg whites are white, and mummies are wrapped... In white cloth.
Okay.
Right. Oh, that is a stretch.
That is a super. Honestly, though, I don't mind the idea, though.
I do think that this drink actually probably would benefit from an egg white.
Here's what I'm gonna say, though. Fuck yellow chartreuse. And you know why? Because I have yet to have a single cocktail that I have had with yellow chartreuse that I have ever thought couldn't just easily be replaced with green chartreuse and be fine. I've not had a single one. I know that's a thing that bartenders have done. Maybe they're smarter than I am. I don't know. But every single time that I use yellow chartreuse, I'm just like, yeah, but what if it was green? And I try it with the green, and it's fucking fine. And I think people are just being, I don't know, like, I'm not going to say they're 100% wrong. I know there are distinct differences. Like, I've tried them back to back. But every single cocktail I've had with one or the other, just, I like the green better. The green just tastes better to me.
They are different, but this could perhaps be akin to our conversation about gin and mezcal, where you just take a bunch of classic gin cocktails and just replace that gin with mezcal. And it's different, but good and better in a different way.
But just better. So here's what we do. Do rye, green chartreuse, matches the green oasis, get that vegetal flavor. We've got some kind of citrus there. Probably lemon, but we could probably go lemon or lime, honestly. I don't know.
I think usually... that lime does not play well with whiskey.
Yeah, that's my general experience, too. Yeah. Lemon's fine. Lemon's fine.
And you know what? Perhaps my bias of whiskey and lemon no is making me feel like whiskey and green chartreuse no, because green chartreuse is green.
Is often so I just paired with
I
lime.
Just have this, yeah, I just have this aversion to comparing, pairing anything green with whiskey, but...
Nah, they're you both know just what? Green. It'll be fine.
I'm totally down to try this. You know what? There is precedent for this. There is a variation on a Manhattan called a Green Point.
Yeah.
Where the only difference is a Manhattan is usually 2 ounces of whiskey, one ounce of vermouth, and then some bitters. A Green Point is 2 ounces of whiskey, half an ounce of vermouth, half an ounce of green chartreuse.
Interesting.
And some bitters. Yeah.
I would probably really enjoy that, actually, because I just like green chartreuse, but I don't
okay,
like
Manhattans. So let's take this. So we're going to take rye whiskey, green chartreuse, lemon, perhaps some simple syrup.
You might need it.
And an egg white, and make this into a... Daisy flip style cocktail.
Yeah.
I think you would want in a tumbler on a rock.
I could see that. I could definitely see that. So, just had this idea, throwing it out there. What if we did it as almost like a New York sour style? Because we've got the egg white, we've got a sour... Well, it's a daisy build, technically, but it's a sour, more or less.
Yeah. Daisies and sours are very close.
Let's top it with some kind of wine. It could be interesting. It'll give it a really, honestly, it might give it a really vibrant color. I don't know how the biggest thing is I don't know how what the color of the base will look like, because you've got the green, you've got the brown of the rye,
and you got the lemon.
You've got the lemons. It's probably gonna come out kind of brownish,
kind of sickly brown green.
The color on that might not be good.
I think we should hold off on topping it with red wine a la a New York sour, because we're going out on a limb here with the green chartreuse. I think maybe...
That's a fair point.
Maybe we can revisit this at some other point and just for now try it with the green chartreuse and see if we can figure out a way to get a balance going with that.
All right. I'm okay with that.
All right. What would we call this drink? It's a strange combination that if you look at it, you would go, and that's exactly the feeling I get at the moment when the door opens and the Dwayne the Rock Johnson Scorpion Centaur comes down, and I say,
what kind of name does that make you want to give it, though? That's my question.
Scorpion Centaur.
Scorpion Centaur? It's a pretty good name.
Scorpion Centaur.
That is a pretty good name. I'll give you that. Because it makes you ask questions like, what? Huh?
We could also just go with Centaur, because it's just like two things that you wouldn't think are go together, kind of mashed together. Rye whiskey and green chartreuse.
Yeah, I could see that. I kind of like Scorpion Centaur. I think Scorpion Centaur is just...
What if we say a Centaur Sour?
See,
the only problem I have with Scorpion Centaur is that makes me think it should be spicy.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, we could make it spicy.
I don't think it needs to be spicy.
There's ways that we can make it spicy.
Yeah. But just a Centaur Sour?
Yeah, Centaur Sour. Centaur Sour. Sounds pretty good to me. Yeah, I would at least try that. Oh, here's a question. What's the garnish? And also, would you want to do a bitters on top of the foam?
You know what? I think no garnish. Just the garnish is a lemon peel expressed over the top and expressed on the edge of the glass and discarded.
Discarded, yeah. Just kind of cover up that egg whitey kind of smell.
That egg white wet dog smell.
Yeah. It's there. I don't get it as much as other people's. I think you definitely get it more than I do usually. But
oh yeah, I definitely smell that wet dog. Anytime there's egg white in a drink, I immediately smell the wet dog kind
of
smell.
I usually go for a good like couple dashes of bitters on top. That's what really covers it for me.
That, you know what? I've never no matter how many dashes of bitters I put on top of that egg white, those never do enough.
Mm. See, I kind of like the bitters because it generally like you kind of cover it a bit, and then you also get to you can make designs in that egg white foam.
Oh no, I still put the bitters on because it's super cute, cool for the cute designs. But I also just always express a citrus peel over a cocktail with an egg white.
That's fair. Yeah, no, I feel like the citrus expression is usually generally good too. For most sours, even not even just egg white, just a nice citrus expression. So I know a lot of people will do just a lemon wedge on a sour, and I'm like, no, do expression. It's better.
Yeah.
Generally.
Okay, so for The Mummy Returns, we're putting down the, like, what am I trying to say? Tangential? No. Rough draft of the cocktail build is 2 ounces of rye whiskey.
Uh-huh.
So it's a rye whiskey. How much green chartreuse? If we're going to make a daisy, actually, do we even want 2 ounces of rye whiskey if we're doing a daisy style build, or do we want 1.5 ounces?
Yeah, you could probably go down to 1.5 ounces because I feel like if you did two of rye and then 1 of green chartreuse, that'd be a lot.
Yeah.
So maybe 1.5 ounces to 3/4.
Half an ounce? Half an ounce green chartreuse?
I feel it. Like, I don't know. Do you want to add sugar into it? Do you want to add sugar into it? Because I think if you go to 1/2 ounce of green chartreuse, I would want to go like 1/4 ounce of sugar or something, like some kind of simple.
But I do think that is, yeah. And then like, well, not like, but I do think, let's just do straight up a margarita daisy build. Mm-hmm. 1.5 ounces of rye whiskey, mm-hmm. 1/2 ounce of green chartreuse,
mm-hmm.
3/4 ounce of citrus, mm-hmm. lemon in this mm-hmm. case, and 1/4 ounce of sweetener, simple syrup, because we don't want it messing with the flavor.
Yeah. I mean, you can go up to like a Demerara or something, probably be fine. Add in a little bit of extra something, but nothing crazy. Probably wouldn't want to do anything weird syrup-wise.
If you have Demerara and that's the only simple you have, go ahead and use that. Mm-hmm. And egg white.
And egg white, yeah.
So, shake, because... Hey, I have a quick question for you while I'm typing this up, while I'm writing this out.
Yeah.
How do you shake your egg white?
Oh, I usually do the traditional double shake.
What is the shake. Traditional double shake?
Dry shake, add ice, shake again.
See, I do a reverse shake. So I build the whole cocktail, add the ice, add the egg white, shake it up, dilute it, chill it, pour the cocktail like off, discard the ice, mm-hmm. and then that's when I start to shake it in order to whip up that egg into a meringue.
Yeah, see, I've generally found the traditional shake to be a little better. My biggest thing is I feel like shaking the egg white while it's warm works better. It does make it put out a bit more gas, but in my general experience it seems to emulsify a little bit better. But that's just me.
Man,
and I feel
see,
like my foam ends up better.
My thought process is always, you know, if you shake it up and get a bunch of air in there as if mm-hmm. you are making a meringue, and then you put ice in there and you shake it up with ice, the ice is punching down all those air bubbles that you forced into the egg white.
Well, so generally what I would, my preferred way to do it is that I would put in like not a bunch of small ice cubes or broken ice. I would put in a large cube or a large cube plus a little bit of broken ice to add more dilution. Because generally, if you use a larger cube, it's going to do that less. So, like, if you do all broken cubes or all small cubes, that is going to break your film up a lot. And I have noticed that before. But generally, the best ones that I have made have been dry shake first with some kind of large cube and maybe some smaller cubes in there for dilution and shaken again. And that big cube really keeps your foam from breaking up too much because it keeps it together.
I could see that. Maybe I'll try
that. That works the best for me. But
honestly,
that's a lot of extra.
Dry shake, reverse dry shake, whichever one works best for you, I think is the way to go.
Whatever you're finding the best results with. The only other big thing I've noticed is I feel like when I have reverse dry shaken, where I have shaken with ice and then dry shake, I do, like, the foam feels fluffier but less dense. That makes any sense. It feels like it's got more air bubbles in it at the time. I don't know if that's because of when you're adding the air, when you're aerating it, because you're aerating it more in the first time you're shaking it, and then you're shaking it again when you're doing a regular shake. Whereas if you reverse shake, you're doing it last, and I feel like it causes the bubbles to be less dense generally.
So like, you're trying to do something, foam, but you see that expands the foam, but expanding the foam means you have more air, which means larger bubbles. I can see that.
And that makes it a little less cohesive. So, like, if you're trying to do something like a bitters design garnish, I would definitely do a regular shake as opposed to a reverse shake. Because anytime I've done a reverse shake, it feels like as soon as I add the bitters to it, it just, like, dissolves almost.
Dissolves? I can see that.
It just goes away. Whereas
I have not had that problem, but maybe it's just because I'm super good at it.
I mean, that could be. It's always going to be variation in what you do. So, I don't know.
Okay. So, it was really great chatting with you, Logan. Had a lot of fun talking almost not about the Mummy Returns, but just about
these in
general, which is how we're going to be taking the second season. We're going to be talking a lot more about booze and cocktails and getting more into the nitty-gritty and trying to talk more in depth, trying not to just brush over things when we say like ABV or other things that we take for granted as professional bartenders, but dive into what we're talking about and why we think the things we think. And so this season is going to be a little bit more focused on the cocktails and a little less focused on the conceit, but the conceit is definitely still going to be there.
Yeah, it'll probably depend on which rock movie it is, because like this one, Not a good movie. Also, not a good rock movie. So
yes,
I'm sure once we get to something like Doom.
Oh, I'm going to talk a lot about Doom.
Yeah, Doom's going to be fun. Doom's going to be a fun one to do. But there's several rock movies right here that are just going to be. He was in it, the movie
He was technically in this movie, and it was a movie. You would like to try the cocktail that we designed. At least the first draft that we designed from this episode, it is the Centaur Sour, 1.5 ounce of rye whiskey, 1/2 ounce of green chartreuse, 3/4 ounce of lemon juice, 1/4 ounce of simple syrup, egg white, shake, reverse, or traditional, whichever one you prefer, serve in a tumbler over a large rock, garnish with a lemon peel expression, and discard the peel.
This sounds pretty tasty. I'm going to try that at some point, actually.
Yeah, I think I definitely want to go try that. Like maybe even tomorrow when I go into work.
I've got all the ingredients at the bar. I might try it tonight.
Yeah, it's easy enough to do. Yeah. All right, well, it was fun talking to you, Logan. I'll see you later.
Great talking to you, bud. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode. I had a lot of fun. Logan, did you have a lot of fun, Logan?
I had a really good time.
Yeah, it was a really good time. We got drunk. We talked about a thing. We made a cocktail.
That sure was a thing.
If you want to hear more about the cocktails that we're making, follow us on Instagram at Cocktail Conceit. We post more than just the cocktails on the show. We post cocktails that we're working on in our outside life. If you want to ask us about media or cocktails or anything in between, contact us by emailing overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Logan, how do you spell that?
I'm not spelling that, Adam, but it is overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Pretty easy to figure out. And if you'd like to further support us, you can join us on Patreon. where you'll get access to exclusive content and cocktails made by yours truly. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Oh, hey, there's Toby.
It's Toby. There he is. He's got a spot. What do you know?